Wessex Press, an imprint of Gasogene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com. The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium held in Maryland, USA for fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It is sponsored by Watson's Tinbox, and if you would like to know more about their next event, their website is www.scintillation.org.
The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Hi.
Good morning. Welcome to the from the holodeck to Baker Street. Shall we introduce ourselves?
That'd be nice.
And say a few words on our connections to.
Yes, my name is Steve Seitz. I'm both an original Trekkie. I was up from the very first broadcast. And Sherlock Holmes has been a part of my life since I was like 12 years old. I was avoiding homework, and I went into the library, came out with a copy of The Hound of the Baskervilles, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm still reading, and I've been hooked on that ever since. So, how many people are really both, or lead one way or the other?
Both is good. Both is good.
I'm looking for the convention rats. I mean, do we all go to both conventions?
Exactly.
This is my second fan convention. My first one was the 1979 Star Trek that I walked into accidentally.
So you're a perfect human. I'm kind of upset right now that no one is cosplaying Riker, just because that's upsetting for me, and no one's cosplaying Troy. So anyway, I am
Which
upset
uniform?
On the asymmetrical,
asymmetrical
teal one,
skin tight.
the teal one with
Can't
the like little that one. So I'm upset on both those counts. My name is Lindsay Fay. I have been a Trekkie since I was alive and watching television. And I came to Sherlock Holmes when I was about 10 years old. And I was done with Nancy Drew. And I told my dad, I'm like, I don't know what to read right now. And he said, why don't you go read a short story? It's called The Adventure of the Speckled Band. And just let me know if you like it. So I read that. And it was over. My life was ruined.
My name is Lynn Stevens, and Star Trek and Sherlock Holmes are my fandom mother and father, basically. I got into Star Trek when I was a young teenager. At the time, Star Trek the Motion Picture came out, and and started loving Sherlock Holmes when the Jeremy Brett series came, and that got me into the books. Mm-hmm. But on the Star Trek side, I have a debt of gratitude to that series. As a teen, I was very lucky that I was able to partner with somebody who had access to a professional audio video editing suite, and we made what would now be called a mashup. There was no term for it back then, but it was we re-edited the first Star Trek movie into a musical comedy.
Please give me the link to it.
Because it, on a very practical and technical terms, you may know that Star Trek, the motionless picture, was rushed into theaters, and they actually never finished the audio on it. So for somebody who had an opportunity and a wit to sit around and make snarky comments about it...
You MST3K'd it.
We didn't know what to call it. It was before any of this. This was in the early 80s. And I won't bore you with the long story, but I ended up being a guest of Roddenberry's on the set of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan as a thank you for the effort, and a few years later became a entertainment journalist for a magazine now defunct called Starlog, and as a part of that did a lot of interviews with the Star Trek folks. who remembered me as the gawky teenager looking for advice on to which college to go to. And let me tell you, it is surreal when the cast of Star Trek is standing on the transporter talking about which college this little girl should go to with her mother standing next to her. It was quite an experience. But the connection for this particular panel is that I had the wonderful fortune of interviewing Daniel Davis, who played Moriarty in the two episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, where he played, like I said, played Moriarty. And in case anybody's interested, I had extra copies of the article from another presentation.
Free
and
stuff.
I'm very happy to hand them out. And if I run out and you're interested in having me send you a PDF of it, if you give me your email address, I'm happy to do that. So that's my connection on the Star Trek side.
I think my closest actual connection on the Star Trek side, to be honest with you, is having met Nicholas Meyer. And that was at the Baker Street Irregulars hosted an event in Los Angeles last year. And it was essentially, it was called Behind the Canonical Screen. And it was about all the film adaptations of Sherlock Holmes. Nicholas Meyer was kind enough to be a guest there. Other stories about Nicholas Meyer are also amazing. But he, interestingly, I think, in terms of somebody who has directed Star Trek films and written pastiches,
yes,
which is the same thing as fanfic, but for money, odd dude, and it was really, really interesting to chat with him about Star Trek and nerd out about it. I would like to, if possible, if we could start with Star Trek connections with the original series, because, you know, chronologically, let's just nerd out about Spock for a second.
Yes.
And and Kirk and all of the most wonderful things that have ever happened. I think that it's important to realize that in 1934, the Baker Street Irregulars were founded, and it was the very beginning of these sort of clubs that were essentially fandom clubs, right? And it wasn't very long after that, wait a second, or before that, that the science fiction folks started doing their own cons, right? Mm-hmm. So then you had
sort of the Gentleman's Club basic. Was the sort of
Isaac Asimov
chassis.
Was
yes.
in all of
yes.
them.
Yes.
So you have everything Isaac Asimov is in. The start of this sort of fan culture, I think, is so tied together with Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek. The Baker Street Irregulars, the Futurists? Is that what they're... Yeah. Futurians. Thank you so much. I was hoping somebody would supply my deficiencies, as Sherlock Holmes would say. So that all happened in the 30s and 40s, and it started happening at a really rapid pace all of a sudden, because everybody was like, oh my god, these things are amazing, and we'd like to talk about them together, and it just dovetailed like crazy. All of the people who were really into sci-fi, all of the people who were really into Sherlock Holmes, suddenly there's clubs. So would either of you like to comment on that? Because I think it's an amazing sort of confluence of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if it weren't for conventions, I never would have had a chance to ask Leonard Nimoy about Spock and Sherlock Holmes.
And what did he say?
It took me 15 years to finally get his attention. I asked the question, and he ruminates a little bit, and then he finally says, Spock is a scientist and Sherlock Holmes is a detective. And I thought, he didn't go beyond the scripts. I don't think he'd ever read a canonical story.
Yeah, there was another quote somewhere else that Leonard Nimoy was asked about the character Spock, and he said, well, you know, you talk about Vulcans being unemotional. What actually he is, he's actually raging with emotions,
yes.
but I control them. And in fact, I just read this in comparison to, I think, Moffat's quote about Holmes has huge emotions. And I think
he's in a glass cage of emotions.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And in fact, you know, we love both these characters because they have an exterior that is very poised and is very outwardly directed and very unemotional. But they wouldn't be so fascinating for us if it weren't for the fact that underneath it all, they actually do have a great deal going on, and it's a powerful actor that can play a character that, that has this facade, but then inside has a great deal of emotions. And we were saying before, there are just so many similarities between Sherlock Holmes and Spock, not least of which they play stringed instruments. They admire that they are themselves brilliant at what they do, and yet they look at another family figure as being even better than themselves. You may remember Sherlock says Mycroft is the better of the detectives.
Yep.
We learn in the original Star Trek series that Spock reveres his father mm-hmm. as being the most
Sarek.
Vulcan. Sarek
yeah.
of Vulcan is being one of the most revered. Both mothers are scientists and
mathematicians.
You have Amanda of Earth being Spock's mother, and we learned so much about Mummy Holmes in season 3 of Sherlock.
I love it.
If you want to embrace that as canon, let's hug it out.
Let's do it.
What else are the similar? I mean,
well, Sherlock Holmes told us nothing, right? In the actual canon. So
right.
Let's,
it's all the stuff.
Let's just embrace canon. Thanks for telling us nothing, dickweed. We'll make it up. You're welcome.
Although there are certain things you can draw from what little was said.
Yes.
I mean, these two, Sherlock and Mycroft are both raised in the country. How come they just both left the farm behind and went into the city and hardly ever saw each other for years and years and years? Something bad happened back there.
I think that that's a lot of people's theory. And speaking of Nicholas Meyer, definitely Nicholas Meyer's theory. I think that the interesting twist that BBC Sherlock has recently done is just saying these are regular human parents.
Right.
I love that as a twist.
Well, they said it's Miles and Fraser Crane. They said it's the Crane family.
Yeah,
the model.
It's the Crane family.
Yeah.
Exactly. So with the original series, we have Spock, right? And then we have this, I would love to talk about Captain Kirk for a long time if we could, but it's not as Sherlockian, so maybe we'll have to move on.
There's a commonality between Kirk and Watson, and that they're...
Yes!
Yes!
Yeah. I didn't say it!
I said it. And absolutely. You're talking about...
Her fault!
I'll embrace it. I'm there.
You know Nicholas Straw and McCoy?
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. But you've got Kirk and Watson who are also masters in their spheres as well, but have also figured out more about embracing their own emotion and lead forward and are examples in some ways of humanity. They are they exemplify kind of integrated human beings, and they are also, of course, the best friends and the conduits, the illuminators.
The conductors of light
for these other individuals. Through which we would not see nearly as clearly. It's fascinating in the early Star Trek, even in the first couple of episodes, where you see Kirk pulling Spock out of himself. They're playing 3D chess and they're having conversations. And Kirk makes a joke about pity you having bad blood like that. They joked about him being a half breed. And this is very early on. And somebody
Cher has all kinds of things to say about that.
but somebody rightly pointed out that you would not make that kind of a joke to a Vulcan unless they were a very good friend.
Yep.
That is not something that would be done lightly. And that if you hadn't had that relationship, you wouldn't make the kind of jokes. And we see that in the Sherlock-John relationship as well.
Absolutely.
So much of their dialogue couldn't happen if they didn't have that deep connection underneath there.
So much of their dialogue is like
orders.
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah.
That's
Kirk,
true.
Kirk is the boss. We're pretty sure about that.
Yeah, I would say one thing I do think is a diametrical opposite. Who's the alpha male of the pair is flipped between the two.
Yes.
I mean, that's possibly one of the most largest distinctions between the two.
I think that's the only
Spock
distinction
could be if
between
you
the two.
To be. Spock could be if you wanted to be.
He could be.
One nerf pinch away from Captain.
Yes, but as he says in the Wrath of
Khan,
I have been and all that shall be yours. And he says that as my service is to you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is very close to the canonical quote, it is my greatest joy and privilege to help you?
Something very similar.
Somebody
will know.
Dying detective. Devil's Foot. It's Devil's Foot.
Yeah.
It is my greatest joy and privilege to serve you, I think, is actually the quote.
Yeah,
so,
another, another yeah. line that crossed over, and I know Nick Meyer was asked about it, was at the end of the Reichenbach Fall, where did anybody else have that sense when we saw John standing at Sherlock's grave, and he said, you're one of the wisest humans.
Best and wisest.
And
yeah.
I sat there, and I honestly said, turned to my husband, I said, oh, my God, they're riffing on Kirk's eulogy of Spock.
But that was riffing
off
already
off of yes.
Nerd room.
Yes.
So that was
but
already.
Nick Meyer did yeah. say, I love BBC Sherlock. It's nice that they repay the favor. They're referencing yeah. that line. That whether that was true or not, he took it.
Best
that
and
way.
Wisest man is originally like the end of
the final problem.
Mm-hmm. So like then all of the riffs,
then they bounce back and forth from one another. But
I know.
There was that one moment where I was terrified that it was going to be too close.
So then you have echoes and echoes and echoes, right?
Yeah.
And like all, I know. A tremendous amount of extremely intelligent humans who hated the new Star Trek, but I loved it.
I loved it.
And I couldn't help it. So I'm sitting next to Christina Menente, who is the Baker Street Babes boss, right? And we're seeing the last Star Trek film, the second one in the series, and I reached out and I grabbed her leg like this when they reversed the Kirk Spock scene.
Yes.
And I grabbed her and I was like, shut the fuck up. What is happening? And I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, no.
Yes.
And she's like, you're really hurting my leg right now. And I'm like, I don't fucking care. And I'm like, she's tweeting. She's like, Lindsay Faye broke my leg.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
She has serious Star Trek problems.
But
I lost it. And like, I know that J.J. Abrams, like, fuck him. Who cares? Like the movie was fun.
It was.
And it was good. And they reversed the Kirk Spock thing.
You know
I
what?
Had feelings.
You know what?
It's not my fault.
You know what the reverse I wish they really had done?
What?
Which would have been so perfect.
What?
If they had made Carol Marcus go for Khan like Marlena McGuire
yes.
in Space Seed.
No.
And if Carol could have borne Khan's child as Carol
yes.
bears Kirk's child in the other...
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap on it. Who's posting the fanfic? Raise your hand. No. This is going to be really good.
That would be
better.
Yeah, because they did not bring, in this version, they did not bring the love interest to Khan.
I know.
The Ricardo Montalban, or Montalcon, as I call it. Cumbercon, Montalcon.
Keep watching for sexy, too. I love
that. Yeah, Spacey, that woman, that MacGyver's. She was not exactly the embodiment of professional womanhood, and as somebody watching it in 2014, you're like, oh, well.
Like, really? that happened.
Well, Ricardo Montalban once said the question he got most out of Wrath of Khan was the chest real?
No.
He said, yes, it is.
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was.
But at some point, we have to get to the holodeck.
Yes. So, yes, let's move on to... obviously, after the original Star Trek series, which was perfect, you get to Next Generation, which is perfect. But but Next Generation is like a strange reverses of the original series. So what you have there thematically going on is that Kirk was this sort of, you know, hot-headed, I'm gonna, you know, like...
Space babes!
Totally, like, I'm a cowboy in space! Pew! Like, that was Kirk. So, then you have a very, very, very smart writer who is saying, we're going to change that for the next series, and you have Picard. And Jean-Luc Picard, who is one of the only celebrities I've ever had sex dreams about.
I've sat at his naked feet.
I'm going to kill you right after this panel. I'm going to take you by the throat, and I'm just going to choke you till you die.
I just saw him on stage. Sorry.
I did, too. I saw his Pinter, and I saw his Godot.
Godot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Both of them. Nerd. So, Picard is this highly intellectual captain, right? So he's gonna switch it up a bit from Kirk. So he's gonna do the, we are going to think this through, I'm gonna communicate with people, we're gonna have all kinds of excellent, like, brain power working on this problem, and I'm not going to punch you in the face. Which then, let's not get to Deep Space Nine yet, but then you have that episode with Sisko, right? And Q shows up, and it's like, and it's like, you punched me. Picard never punched me. And he's like, I'm not Picard. So you have these, every sort of other captain, you have to have a different ethos, right? A different sort of modus operandi that the captain has. So Picard is a very intellectual captain, and we had in the person of Data a very Spock-like figure who is also related to Sherlock Holmes in many ways, and yes, we can talk about the holodeck, but thematically already you have Data. What do you think of Data and Brent Spiner, because he's so perfect?
What's not to love about Data? I thought that the ongoing philosophic questions that the series pose and were posed actually very dramatically.
Is this a person?
In the especially
the trial episode. What was that one called?
Measure of a Man.
Yes. Oh my God!
I love that undercurrent question about at what point does intelligence become sentient, and when is a sentient being afforded the rights and opportunities that we take as granted as living life forms? And I think that fundamentally is at the heart of the two episodes that Moriarty is in.
Yes,
in episode,
that's true too.
In Elementary Dear Data and Ship in a Bottle in seasons two and season six. Mm-hmm. The underlying questions that are posed are really very thoughtful ones. And
I think they're the same ones that are posed in Measure of a Man, actually.
Yeah, at what point do you then have to give the rights and responsibilities of someone? I think that to me was the key question in the first episode where we meet Moriarty. And if you haven't seen it, the one line is Data and Geordi are playing Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And
Geordi, I'm sorry, LeVar Burton is the first race bent Watson ever.
Yes.
And
yes.
He's
awesome.
So perfect.
And what an underlying point to the entire episode, which I love, that just goes unmentioned, is Sherlock Holmes as a literature character will still be beloved in the 23rd century.
Oh, yes.
I think that's... You have to say it, because it just sort of assumes...
Facts.
That it...
I'm just going to mention not just Holmes, but literature generally.
Yeah,
the next generation. Picard has a complete works of Shakespeare laid open on his
stand. Yep.
There's a love of great works that continues on, but
thanks for pointing that out.
Yes, but it's great the whole underpinning of the episode is that they love Sherlock Holmes and they want to play the game. Mm-hmm. And then the point being
they want to play the game better than we can because we don't have holodecks.
Yeah, if you guys don't have holodecks, it'd be great. So they go to play play Sherlock Holmes, and Geordi doesn't enjoy it because they're just the computer's just running the loop of existing stories, and Data is solving them in 2 seconds. Yeah. And the whole crux of the episode is the what chaos is wreaked when Geordi tells the computer, create an adversary that is worthy of Data.
Yeah,
does not say worthy of Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And a generic...
But Watson would have said, create an adversary worthy of Sherlock Holmes, so it's exactly right. Because this is the friend who is, like, your brain is superior, and we need something for you to be matched against. Yeah, it's
so
perfect.
So when the computer pulls that, I mean, it takes so much power to create Moriarty that the ship sort of does the thing when the lightning strikes and the power in your office building dims.
It's like when Troy has feelings, you know?
pain!
Yes, yes!
Sorry, I love Marina Sirtis. Also, trivia question. Oh, this is a good trivia question. You could win a very important thing if you answer my trivia question. Ready? Marina Sirtis played Troy in Star Trek The Next Generation. If you shoot your hand in the air and tell me what Sherlock Holmes character she played, I will give you this thing. Hand!
Wasn't she Adler?
Nope. That was,
I know this is going to work, but I can't remember.
Honeycutt. Gail Honeycutt.
The Greek interpreter.
Yes.
Yes, it was the Greek interpreter.
What's the name of the character?
All right, you all think about it. Don't use your phones. Anyway.
I did ask her about that episode once.
Did you? Okay. What did she say?
Well, she said...
I love her in that episode.
Oh, yeah. Well, she said Jeremy Brett. He never broke character. On the breaks, he was...
He was very method, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. During the breaks, he'd be rereading the original story and comparing it to the script.
That's actually perfect.
Yeah, and he's also
Dalton like the writer.
Yeah,
right. Be better than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
On the fly.
He was already a heavy smoker, so he didn't have to worry about that part. Conan Doyle didn't have any idea, obviously. He said he was looking forward to cigars in heaven one day.
Oh, Conan Doyle.
And whiskey.
Yes. Speaking of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and ways in which he fails, Moriarty is not, I always say this and I can't shut up about it, so I apologize because some of you have probably already heard it, but his Moriarty is an afterthought. And Moriarty he's just like, die, is essentially like the whole inner monologue of the final problem. And it's a backward story and it's bizarre because, you know, you walk up to your partner in not crime, your partner in crime fighting, and you say, hey, ever heard of my arch nemesis? Watson's like, nope. Right. So yeah. That's the kind of story you're telling. So you're doing it wrong.
My theory on that is that Watson shaded everything.
I have the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to avoid libel, you know, changing the names, changing the dates. Yeah.
Change all the stuff. So the Moriarty on the holodeck is actually very interesting because this is a person who is created to be a direct adversary of Data for Data. Mm-hmm.
Which is why he doesn't look a thing like Moriarty.
Right, and he's given the character of Moriarty, but they make it very clear that the minute he becomes sentient, he takes off far beyond what that stock Victorian character would have been in the earlier iteration of the holodeck program. And he talks about, you know, where I was mentally before I met this computer that is now educating me, and where he goes now. And he says, you know, my intellect just grows at a prodigious rate, and he is smart enough to tap into the computer and learn absolutely everything, except, weirdly enough, that he's on a starship in the middle of the universe, because he is still completely blown away about that when he goes to 10 forward in the second episode.
Yeah, so, they're boldly going.
Yeah, they're boldly going, but he didn't know they were boldly going. He knows he's on a ship, but he doesn't know that it's not on water, so there's little bits
weird.
Well, he is a Victorian character. Some things are
right.
tough to come to.
There is a wonderful goof in the first episode. Mm-hmm. That if you know it very well, there is a moment where Geordi and Data come out and they have the picture of the holodeck that Moriarty has drawn.
Mm-hmm. It shouldn't survive.
It should not have survived. It should not have survived. But do you know why that was left? Do you know why they did that to begin with? Because there was an alternate ending that they were going to film to the first episode, and Roddenberry shot it down. The original ending of Elementary Dear Data had Picard lie to Moriarty.
Oh,
and because when that piece of originally in the script, that piece of paper goes off the holodeck, they realized this piece of paper should not have come off the holodeck, and that becomes part of the story, part of the narrative, and that means Picard realizes that Moriarty's danger is incredibly real, and he could walk off the holodeck if he wanted to.
It's physical. Yeah.
So that's where Picard goes to Moriarty and basically has the same ending and says, you can't step out that door, you can't cross that line, you're going to disappear. Lying. Roddenberry read the script and said Picard would never lie.
That's
one of the biggest arguments that Berman had with Roddenberry about that script was the character of Picard. And Roddenberry stood firm and said the character will not lie.
Picard wouldn't. It's true.
And Berman said he would lie to protect the ship because he knows Moriarty to this point is the greatest villains. But Roddenberry won. Roddenberry won. And in essence, gutted the ending of the story because the story is basically Picard going,
it's a
ending. Scary to me, and could you just go into this bottle? Could you go into the genie bottle until we can figure you out? And Moriarty goes, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
there's actually no real denouement. Yeah. It's sort of like I'm going to put you in a bottle because the original ending.
That makes so much more sense now. Explained it.
Well, if I'd written it, somebody would have pressed the delete button, but then we would never have had the second
episode.
Because my entire files disappear on their own without me touching anything. So
of course.
Right, exactly. It's nice to know files get corrupted, because that's the entire basis of the second episode.
Yeah. It is.
Right.
Do you
maintenance
guys,
counts, people.
Do you guys find any parallel between the Moriarty character and the Doctor in Voyager? Because I find that an archetype, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I think that is
the pissed off hologram.
Yeah. But he's so sweet.
What's Latin for? I think therefore I'm pissed off.
Yeah. Exactly.
Ergo piss offo.
Ergo. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of parallels there. Like, just as a... and, you know, one thing that I like about the Star Trek universe, and all of the universes, is that they continue and that they expand. So you have this original Gene Roddenberry vision, which is the most perfect thing ever to happen, which is to say, let's put a black woman and a Russian on the bridge in 1960-whatever.
Six.
And this, thank you. Supplying my deficiency. And then this whole ethos, right? This is carried on to the Klingons are the bad guys, right? Well, in Next Generation, who's on the bridge? A Klingon, because that's how we operate. We're going to get past it, and everybody is going to get better. It's going to get better, and we're going to get along with each other eventually. So now you've got Next Generation, and you've got a Klingon on the bridge, and the Borg are the bad guys. What happens next? 7 of 9. So this is a continuing thing that is amazing, and I love the Moriarty character already, but I do think it's kind of like a previous, you know, sort of like just half-imagined incarnation of the Doctor on Voyager.
The first steps.
Yeah, the first steps. And this is like a hologram, but this is a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I asked Picardo about that once. Actually, it was my first celebrity interview.
What did he say?
Well, I said, well, how do you get to the heart of a character like that?
Yeah.
And he said, well, at first I just thought he was, you know, he was an overwhelmed holographic doctor with a bad attitude. But I realized then that he was taking on the full burden. He was supposed to be a temporary,
right? But he's
a temporary physician self, and all of a sudden he's the ship's doctor, and he's got a lot to grapple with.
Yeah, he does.
And there's nobody he can talk to.
There are
really
problems on Voyager.
Yeah.
You know, what's he supposed to do? Go to the holodeck himself and talk to Beowulf. You know, who's the doctor's friend?
Right. Who's the doctor's friend?
That's
a great question.
That's a beautiful segue into Moriarty's problem in the second episode, which is he's one of. You guys would know better than I, but has Moriarty ever had a love interest in any other?
He only appears twice in the entire canon.
Well, and even in his pastiches,
he doesn't appear to very good effect.
John Gardner's books.
No, but he's so much older, and Daniel Davis actually pointed out in the interview, he's like, my Moriarty is a little bit more robust and younger and healthier than. Because he read canon. Daniel Davis also played Watson in Crucifer of Blood. So
yes, he did.
He had a connection to. Sherlock before this particular episode, but in the second episode, Moriarty has a love, the Countess Regina, and I find the middle part of the second episode is actually Frankenstein.
Yeah,
it's really what it is.
That's completely true.
And almost, if you watch the episode with that in mind, almost line for line, when Moriarty is saying, from a rights perspective, how dare you create me and then leave me to live
by myself? Frankenstein. Mm-hmm.
And then the
that
whole.
Is- 100% Mary Shelley.
And nobody said, you're protons, man. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah.
And then the Frankenstein going off and making his own decisions, we now have the group hug and group meeting on Star Trek because you can't make a decision independently. You all have to sit in a room with a formal meeting and decide whether or not it's...
Kirk doesn't.
Right. Kirk runs off and makes
Picard has...
Kirk's like, I am the decider.
Exactly.
Well, no, he gives his opinions first. Kirk will ask McCoy. He'll ask Spock.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll choose one. Sometimes he'll choose the other. Sometimes he'll just go down the middle.
Right. Picard has a quorum and puts out a manifesto or
spreading the blame out here.
But they decide that they're not going to let Moriarty. They don't want to have Moriarty have a partner because, from an ethical perspective, they don't even know what they've got in him, much less starting to create someone else. But he's gone off and
such morally complicated episodes. And I got to say that, like, one of the biggest connections between Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek. And I would like to announce also that I am about to be founding a Scion in New York called Data, Data, Data. Data, Data, Data. I cannot make bricks without clay. I cannot. Is going to be a Sherlock Holmes Star Trek Scion, and we are going to. The purpose of it is to take one canonical case from the books and one episode from any incarnation of Star Trek, and we're going to talk about both of those during the meeting. So that's the plan. If you live in New York, you're invited. Please contact me, lindsay@bakerstreetbabes.com, if you would like more information about that, but I haven't planned the first meeting, but we're going to, and we definitely need to do, like, the final problem and the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Duh. But... Anyway, the thing that is so perfect about Star Trek and about Sherlock Holmes is that these are very morally complicated issues that all the heroes are facing, right? So you see them grappling with things that they don't quite know what their own opinions are at first. And then they end up making very reasonable decisions about them, and they end up trying to understand people. Like, look at the blue carbuncle, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of it, Sherlock's like, you're a real asshole, but I figure you're going to be less of an asshole not going to jail than going to jail. Mm-hmm. So let's just pretend it didn't happen. That's just, you're a guppy, so let's put you back in the pond, right? And, like, that happens on Star Trek all the time, where they encounter people where they have no real, like, we have no connection with you folks, and we don't know what you're doing, but we're going to try to understand it, and we're going to make the most reasonable moral decision that we can.
Or we'll just barrel all in. Prime directive? What prime directive?
Maybe I'm more on a Picard note right now. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right.
We care about everybody but you,
Kirk's like, there's a space baby. Hey!
Hey, green lady.
Exactly. Want to see my diodes?
Right. You look tasty. Yes. But it's always this sort of, you know, I find it to be a progressive narrative in both of the canons, Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek, and I think that they overlap so efficiently because everybody is trying to make the world a better place ultimately.
Yes.
And one of them is extremely logical and one of them has a lot of feels and whether it's the captain or not is sort of switched. Right? But
but
you know, it. And then you switch it, so bizarrely, you've got the original series, you've got Kirk as the sort of, I'm gonna, you know, blow my cannon any which way I like, after, you know, reasonable...
Well, of course, at the time the original Star Trek came out, every other show on TV was a Western.
Yeah, so he's very much a cowboy, and then
point. Ragged Twain to the Stars was the original concept.
Precisely, and then you have Spock, and then you have a reversal, really a great reversal again in Next Generation, and they do this every other series, which is Riker. Just raise your hand if you're a Riker fan. Come on. Yeah. I know. There should be more hands. Okay. So Riker is epic and Picard is the intellectual on the bridge of Next Generation. And so, you know, you have that dynamic again. And you have to have, you know, the certain lines drawn between your two main characters. So that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you're getting further and further. And then there's an African-American man playing Sisko on Deep Space Nine. And then you have a lady captain in Voyager. And then let's not talk about Enterprise because that never happened.
But they really blew it. I mean, they had
Enterprise didn't happen!
Well, something did.
Steve
I was there.
Is right.
Oh, I could go on for at least an hour about what was wrong with Enterprise.
No! But it's been a long road.
Yeah, that's the first thing.
That's the first thing. And what's wrong with Enterprise?
Yeah, that's the Star
Getting
Trek Paramount
one. From there to here.
And now they finally got it in the movie franchise, which is unfortunate. But
yeah. You're welcome! Yeah.
How are we doing on time, by the way?
I think we have... Yep. Yeah, we're good.
Okay.
Let's do Q&A then. Yeah.
I ask, if I could write fan fiction, I would have already written this, but you seem to be, you know, into it a bit more. Has there ever been a story, because I wanted to write this if I could, we know that the Enterprise, the original Enterprise, could travel back in time, sometimes accidentally, but could.
Whales.
We know that Spock
Space
went
whales.
Through Pon Farr and had to mate. Mm-hmm. Now, we know there are similarities between Spock and Sherlock. If the Enterprise happened to go back in time to the, say, 1850s, and Spock was in Pon Farr, well...
Wait a second.
Wouldn't that explain a lot?
Shut the front door.
Has anyone ever...
I'm sure they have.
This is headcanon accepted.
Yeah. But also, we also...
What did you just say?
Personally, my theory is that's the reason there's a holodeck in the first place, because Vulcan's going crazy in space now to get back to the planet in 7 years.
Your theory is that Pon Farr created it's Sherlock Holmes due to a time traveling enterprise.
Yeah.
Let me love you.
My question is weird.
Look where we are.
Oh, if you can top that one.
Like Jay and Jordy were like my first Holmes and Watson. Like,
yeah, me too.
Before I was Sherlock. Yeah. And like I remember the year I started watching Star Trek, I saw Undiscovered Country in the theater. I'm like 9 years old. And I'm like so excited.
Yeah.
And I realized later Nicholas Meyer directed that. There is a quip in there when they're hunting down the murderer, and he does a riff on the "Once You Eliminate the Impossible, Whatever Remains."
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Spock references one of my ancient Earth ancestors. Yeah. So I'm like,
yep.
Is that his?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, you're implying that he's his own father.
Hey, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
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 I just wanted to say I love that.
Did you?
It's canon now.
Yeah. I seem to remember in the early '80s or sometime. I think it was fan fiction. Okay. I don't think there has been a professional pastiche that addressed that. I don't know if they could
fan fiction and pastiche.
Well, it depends. The problem with Star Trek novels is that there's a certain pool of agents that they use, and if you're not in that pool, your manuscript does not get read.
Speaking as someone who has definitely never read Imzadi, the Star Trek novel.
Or the sequel.
I've never read the sequel either. Lies. We should write this.
Oh, I've thought about it. I've worked out a plot, but I need an agent.
Yonder in the back had a question, I think.
Oh, I should basically wanted to say the same thing about my ancestor.
But we don't know on which side, do we?
Everything it, Bob is saying makes
have
sense.
To be.
It would have to be the mother side.
Yes.
Perhaps the ancestor could have been Bell, the model that Doyle, one of the models that...
Joe Bell. Bring Joe Bell into it.
Yeah,
so, I like it.
Yeah, that's a thought.
It is a good thought. Nerd questions, yes.
You might be able to answer this. My understanding was that when they did the first Next Gen episode, Elementary Dear Data, that Paramount got kind of a cease and desist.
Yes.
Doyle Estate, because they thought it was public domain.
Yeah, what happened was actually it was a mistake in that that wasn't rectified for a number of years. They actually had wanted to go back and do Ship in a Bottle relatively soon after episode 2, Elementary Dear Data.
Yeah.
But what had happened, and chime in if you know more than I, but mm-hmm. Paramount had actually sent the letter more about, not Paramount, the Conan, the Doyle Estate had sent the note about Young Sherlock Holmes, another Paramount property at the time. They weren't actually all that concerned about the Star Trek episode. It took some years to rectify that. They had wanted to do Ship in a Bottle much sooner than waiting for the 4 to 5 years they did. And ultimately they were able at a reasonable price to go back and do
if I could expand on that just a little bit. Under the original copyright laws, everything Conan Doyle wrote went into the public domain in 1980, the 50th year of his death. And what happened was
Sonny Bono.
We're getting there. Yeah, so there were some there, but after 1980, you know, the Conan Doyle estate was not going to give up that easily, and they managed to get some of the stories, not everything, but some of the stuff, most of the Sherlock Holmes stuff, grandfathered in to another round of copyright.
Everything but the casebook.
Yes, and then Sonny Bono came along and ruined everything, and the trees got him, and I'm not crying.
Oh God, harshing it up a notch.
Oh yeah.
But Sonny
went off to find a former splinter group.
Sonny was... Oh, my God.
More detail, please.
Sonny was hired by Disney, essentially. And Disney had a giant shit fit when they realized that Mickey Mouse was about to go into public domain. So when they realized Mickey Mouse was about to be everybody's, then they decided that they would solicit Sonny Bono as a congressman, and he would change copyright law. He did. Copyright law is now extremely complicated. If you want to know more about Sherlocky and copyright law specifically, there is a lawsuit ongoing at the moment.
He won.
And they appealed. Well, okay, so it's not straightforward at the moment, but yes, Klinger won. Les Klinger, who is the editor of every annotated thing you've ever seen. He lives to annotate, and he's lovely. He is a very brilliant lawyer, and he and Laurie King were co-editing a collection of Sherlock Holmes mysteries by modern authors, and the Conan Doyle estate sent them a cease and desist or pay us because it's basically a shakedown scheme. And they said no. So that turned into a giant court case. Les won the initial court case, but they appealed. Then there was a rebuttal to the appeal. If you want to follow it, it's all hashtag free Sherlock. And the babes have some literature on it, but I would just, you know, look at all of the internet things and like read them carefully.
Yeah.
Essentially, Sherlock Holmes is out of copyright prior to the casebook, which was published in 1923. So everything previous to that ought to be public domain, and is, in fact, public domain. That doesn't mean they don't ask people for money regarding things that are based on those earlier stories, but they're also trying to trademark Sherlock Holmes, which would actually be much worse. So if you're interested in this question of legalities, then definitely look it up. But regarding the Star Trek episode, yes, that would have happened much faster if it hadn't been for certain party.
Yeah. Well, the estate hasn't... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that just leave him in that bottle for so many years.
And he says he was able to note that the passage of time, that was one of the things that from a morale and ethical
and that
perspective...
torturous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was the most disturbing thing I found about that second episode is that you've got a sentient person that you've essentially put in solitary for... ever.
Yeah, and he has no idea if someone is ever going to come do anything for him. I mean, it's
which
cruel.
Is gross. That's really gross.
Know, you kind of understand. You to talk about understanding the villain's perspective.
Yeah.
You certainly go into that second episode understanding it. One aside, if you watch the second episode, take a look when they're in the sitting room of 221B and look at the portrait, the oval portrait over the fireplace. You will swear that it is a portrait in Victorian garb of Philip Anderson from Sherlock. I'm sure it isn't, but the resemblance is so striking that I was watching it. My husband walked in the room.
Oh my God!
He's sort of not a fanboy, but he's like, "Isn't that Anderson from Sherlock?" And I was like, "Well, given that this episode was filmed,
bearded Anderson or regular
Anderson in a high Victorian collar." So
next
time you watch the episode, freeze frame on that deck. And on the 221B scene, and look, I think it is absolutely hysterical and completely serendipitous. But
I'm ready. You were gonna say
something? I was gonna mention it may be a legal precedent for the trademarking of fictional characters because I think Tarzan is trademarked.
Yeah, they did do that, and trademark is very problematic. Not to turn the Star Trek panel into a trademark or rights panel, but very briefly, trademark is much more troublesome than copyright, because if you trademark something, it's just, you know, like a Coca-Cola label, right? And you just can't put it anywhere. You can't touch it. So essentially, if they manage to trademark Sherlock Holmes, even the Baker Street Journal, which is the quarterly journal of the Baker Street Irregulars, wouldn't be allowed to exist without paying trademark. It would be a very bad thing.
But I think also it's too late. Yeah, the estate's never gone after me. You know, I don't make nearly enough money. They don't care unless it's big money.
I paid them a lot of money.
I've got a solid copyright from the United States. You know, they can't touch me. They had 2 years.
Yeah. 2 years later, you're fine. So regarding Star Trek, if anybody wants to talk about any other incarnations of Star Trek that we skipped, then I apologize for skipping them, because there's so much Star Trek. There's all the Star Trek. There's movies. We didn't talk about the movies. We didn't talk about, really, the reboot all that much. Would you guys like to talk about any other versions of Star Trek that we skipped? Because we were mostly original series and next gen, which is, like, that's my wheelhouse, really.
Yeah.
But, like...
Well, okay. In the reboot, how would you define the Sherlock-Watson dynamic? Where would you put it?
Yeah, the reboot is super interesting. So, like, personally, I think that they got Kirk a bit wrong.
Completely.
Yeah.
Utterly. Totally.
Kirk is...
I want to throttle the screenwriters. They didn't even bother watching the original show.
Thank you. Yes. So I still really liked it because...
Oh, it's entertaining. Don't get me wrong. It's entertainment value.
It's great. And the casting is perfect.
The casting.
And Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto should just snuggle forever. But, yeah, it's...
They got Kirk
Can
weird.
Can you be more specific about why you don't like Pine and Kirk?
I love Pine as Kirk.
Well, yes,
because Kirk in the original series is a feminist.
Is a what?
A feminist.
Yes.
And Kirk in the original series is a rampant feminist. And you have all these examples of this in various episodes where someone's wandering onto the bridge and saying, oh, that's a sexy lady. And he's like, that's a crewman. She's actually a big deal. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
So Kirk is a feminist. And they wrote him as a slightly overgrown teenager with bad hormone problems.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Pine is a great Kirk. But the way they wrote him is not the way the original Kirk is written, and that is my problem with Kirk.
And I would say, I wouldn't say as a rebuttal, but I would say the reason I sort of swallowed that kind of whole cloth was that in the J.J. Abrams reboot, we're actually meeting the characters at a younger point in their lives. We're meeting them when they're yet formed.
That's fair.
And it's sort of like J.J. Abrams to the original is sort of like the Sherlock to canon. You're trying to meet them in a more unformed stage of their development.
True. Yeah.
So that's how I was able to process all these changes.
That's true.
I see it more as that he is fundamentally different because he had a completely different childhood.
It
doesn't have father influence. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So I don't expect...
That's another Sherlockian connection, by the way. Yeah. His mom was on House. House is Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because in the second movie to the reboot, they actually introduced Han.
Right.
And that is further in the series where he would have had more, I guess, feminist leanings, and that wasn't in effect. Both of those movies, they're great. I also love them, but there's a lot of...
There's a lot of wankery going on.
Oh, are you kidding? They completely threw out the original history.
Yeah.
He's got time to be pussy.
Yeah, I mean, I thought one really brilliant thing that he did was by going back and changing the timeline, it gives him the freedom.
Yes, they wrote themselves a free slate.
They wrote themselves a free slate, but that was smart. That was very smart. The thing that I wanted was to keep intact the fact that Kirk is like, you don't muck with ladies. Ladies want to have sex with me. That's not a problem.
But
the ladies like having sex, and they like having it with me. That's not a big deal. But you don't mess with ladies on my watch. So that's what I wanted from Chris. Yeah.
I saw the scene where he takes Uhura with him to Praxis, to the Klingon homeworld, as being very respectful of her
abilities. That was respect.
And the fact that she goes out and she is toe-to-toe with the badass, the Banff Klingon guys, and the boys are not stepping out of the ship to rescue her. Now, in the series, it would have been, oh, Captain, and Kirk would have come out with the phasers flying, and in this episode, her smarts and her linguistic ability are allowed to save the day, and the boys let her ride.
I would like to say also that it is extremely important for everyone here to remember that... Yes, we are.
Yeah,
we're being booted, but I'm still here. But we're being booted for a thing that I'm already on here, so I can keep talking for 2 seconds. What is her name? Nichelle Nichols. Okay, so Nichelle Nichols was ready to quit Star Trek, right? She was sick of it. She's like, this is really annoying. This is so much sci-fi. I can has phasers. Okay, fine. She's like, I'm done. This is a silly, silly show, and I'm going to quit it. And I have a lot of, you know, like... beefs with people, so I'm just going to stop. She met Martin Luther King Jr. at a party, and he said, do you understand how important you are and what you're doing on television and how big a deal it is? And she said, no, Martin Luther King Jr. I was unaware of the fact that you found this important. And it is a perfect anecdote because she then went back and said, okay, Gene Roddenberry, I know I said I'm quitting, but I believe you now when you say that this is a big deal. And I'm going to stay and I'm going to continue to do the series because Star Trek is important. It's one of the most important things I've ever watched.
Absolutely.
Changed everything.
Life-changing. Literally life-changing.
Changed everything.
Yep.
Yeah. Inspired Dr. Mae Jemison.
Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan.
She watched Star Trek as a little girl.
Correct.
She saw a black lady.
I saw a black lady on television and she was on the bridge. That's 100% correct.
Michelle Nichols also ended up being paid more than almost anyone else other than the main cast because the studio refused to hire her on as a regular actor.
Yep.
She was a contract actor
yep.
for the entire series of the show.
Correct.
Getting a huge amount of money for it.
Yep. Good. Michelle Nichols wins at everything is the moral of today.